I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. 240 years ago, just weeks after the colonies had declared their independence from Great Britain, George Washington's army was outnumbered and outmaneuvered. The rebels would likely have been wiped out and the revolution over before it began, except for the elite unit of Maryland fighters who repeatedly attacked British headquarters, buying a precious hour for the bulk of Washington's army to escape. 256 Marylanders were killed in the Battle of Brooklyn in New York. Where they are buried is still a mystery. But the Maryland regiments went on to supply the margin of victory in dozens of battles. Military historian Patrick O'Donnell tells their story in Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the Revolution. He's our guest on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've joined us. In this hour, we're going to plant ourselves back in history exactly 240 years to the last week of August in 1776. It's been a little over a month since the Continental Congress in Philadelphia voted for independence from Great Britain, and the news drew cheers and huzzas when it was read aloud to the odd assortment of amateurs who make up the nascent American Army. It's been weeks since half the British Navy and two-thirds of the British Army showed up on hundreds of transports and warships in New York Harbor. And John Hancock of Massachusetts, president of the Continental Congress, put out a call to the colonies for troops. Hancock urged the Maryland Convention, quote, to strain every nerve and send forward your militia. This is a step of such infinite moment that in all probability your speedy compliance will prove the salvation of your country, end quote. Nine companies of men set out from Maryland, and now in late August, the Marylanders make up part of the Patriot force on the heights of Brooklyn, preparing to confront the Redcoats and Hessians in the early light of August 27th. No one yet knows the astonishing courage the Marylanders will show in this battle, the horrifying losses they'll absorb, and how they will serve as General Washington's elite shock troops. Our guide to the Maryland line is Patrick O'Donnell, a military historian who has written 10 books about modern martial exploits, including First Seals and Beyond Valor. He was the only civilian military historian in a U.S. Marine rifle platoon during the Battle of Fallujah, and he's consulted on military documentaries. His latest book reaches back 2.5 centuries. It's titled Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the Revolution. And Patrick O'Donnell is with me in the studio. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks, Sheila. It's great to be here.
Before we talk about what drew you to this story and who these Maryland men were, tell us about this first battle. Tens of thousands of Redcoats and Hessians outnumbering the Americans at least 3-1. The Marylanders were outflanked. When did Washington realize he needed to retreat?
It wasn't until actually a day or two later after the battle began that he actually made the decision to retreat from Brooklyn Heights. The Battle of Brooklyn is the largest battle of the American Revolution, and it was a point in the American Revolution that the war could have been completely lost. And that's where I think that's what makes it so important. It's an inflection point in the Revolution where had things gone, you know, a certain way, the way of the British or the Hessian soldiers there, they could have had a crushing victory and destroyed the American army and potentially captured Washington. And, you know, our story is Washington's Immortals is about the Marylanders that made an epic stand that charged multiple times into a house that was occupied by Cornwallis that allowed a large portion of the American army to escape that day. And, you know, I found this story just incredibly compelling. And it's a story that I sort of that found me about 6 years ago.
How did it find you?
6 years ago, I was in New York City, and I was, as you mentioned earlier, I was in the Battle of Fallujah with a Marine rifle platoon. I was a combat historian. I was a civilian, but ended up going house to house with a Marine rifle platoon, barely survived, was ambushed many, many times. And that experience created a really some strong ties to a brotherhood with the Marines that I was with, including the commanding officer of that unit, Colonel Willie Buell. And Colonel Buell was assigned to Brooklyn, or to New York City, I should say, to the Council of Foreign Relations as a liaison officer. And he asked me, we were both up there at the time, he's like, well, do you want to go to the Met, Pat? And I said, no, I'd like to, how about we do a battlefield tour of Brooklyn? I'd done a bunch of research on it, and we had met at Greenwood Cemetery, where the battle begins. And it's interesting, Greenwood Cemetery wasn't there, obviously, but it's still the largest heights in Brooklyn are Greenwood, a place called Battle Hill. And the battle actually begins outside the gates of Greenwood Cemetery at the Inn of the Red Lion. That's what there was an inn there. And interestingly enough, they had a watermelon patch in the backyard. And the pickets on August 27th that night met in that watermelon patch. They were sort of foraging. And that sort of kicks off this largest battle of the American Revolution. We met there. We went into Greenwood Cemetery, went up Battle Hill where the battle, a large part of the battle was fought, went down the hill in and around several alleys in Brooklyn. And we came upon the old stone house where... This is the focal point where many companies of Marylanders charged several times with fixed bayonets into this house that created a gap in the British lines that allowed a large portion of the American army that was on the Heights of Gowanus near Greenwood Cemetery to escape back to their fortifications. And then we walked a couple blocks further and we found an American Legion post, the Michael Raleigh American Legion post. We went through it, and it had several like Marine posters and pictures on the walls of veterans that had, you know, been part of the post. And outside, we found a rusted old sign that said, "Here lie 256 Continental soldiers, Maryland heroes." And I became obsessed. Why is there an old sign on this, you know, American Legion post, marking a mass grave for men that potentially saved the United States that day? And that became a mystery to me. Why are they, where's the mass grave? Who are these men? What made them do what they did? And what was the backstory? And I just became obsessed from that point on with sort of uncovering their story. And their story is not just a story about the Battle of Brooklyn. It begins, you know, a couple blocks from here in a tavern. On a wintry day in 1774, where men of honor, family, and fortune founded the Baltimore Independent Cadets, which is the first independent company which the Maryland National Guard traces its lineage to, but becomes this thing called the Maryland Line, these elite troops. And that is just the beginning of an 8-year saga of these Marylanders that fight in nearly every major battle in the American Revolution, in the North and in the South, in places like Cowpens, at Guilford Courthouse, Eutaw Springs, Camden. And they're not just fighting there. They're in many cases, like you said earlier, these are the shock troops. These are the men that Washington relies upon to, in some cases, change the course of a battle. And so it's an incredible story.
That's Patrick O'Donnell, military historian, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book, Washington's Immortals, The Untold Story of an Elite Regiment Who Changed the Course of the Revolution. You're talking about 1774, 2 years before America has declared independence, before the Continental Congress declared independence from Great Britain. Yet it sounds as if these men already expected to fight.
These men are incredible men. They're the basic core unit that starts out Washington Immortals and that provides the tissue matter that spreads into many multiple regiments that are some of the greatest fighting regiments of the American Revolution. The core leadership come from this small group, the Baltimore Independent Cadets. And they are some of the wealthiest men in Baltimore City. There, many of them are merchants. They are sea captains, and skilled, sometimes skilled tradesmen, lawyers, etc. They have a thirst for liberty. They see the issues before them, and they're willing to throw their fortunes down the drain. They basically are willing to put their careers on hold. And their careers are trading with Great Britain at the time.
So they have a lot at stake.
They have everything at stake. And not only are they willing to throw their fortunes down the drain, but they're also willing to throw their lives away. And that's what actually happens by signing a document which could be construed as a death sentence because they are committing treason against the crown. They're breaking all the laws of the land. They are outfitting themselves with weapons, the best weapons and uniforms that money can buy, and they're beginning to train. And they have their own drill master, a guy by the name of Richard Carey, who had some militia experience up in Massachusetts, and Carey trains these men. The main focal point of the group is a guy by the name of Mordecai Gist, and Gist is the wealthiest, arguably one of the most wealthiest members of the cadets, and he's the leader also of the group. And they pledge their lives and fortunes, and they say that they will be willing to fight on 48 hours notice on any colony that's attacked within the area of Maryland. And they, as I mentioned, they start to train. And you know, as I'm going through these, I spent 6 years uncovering this story. The documents are I couldn't believe some of the things that I found. But one of the most extraordinary letters that I found was in the Gist papers. It was a letter that was dated February 1775, and it was an anonymous source, and they had seen the cadets drilling in the area right around the studio. And they sent a letter
in Charles Village.
Yes, and they sent a letter to Gist saying that you will face an American Thermopylae. I'm sort of summarizing, but that was a thing. And the author of this letter predicted that they would be American Spartans essentially, and they would face tens of thousands of enemy soldiers. It's an incredibly prophetic letter that occurs over a year and a half before the Battle of Brooklyn, and it's signed Agamemnon, the king that unites Greece against the Persians.
Part of what is amazing about your description of the what motivated these wealthy, for the most part, young Marylanders, is that it was not a universal attitude in Maryland. You write about that it was essentially the first Civil War
absolutely.
In Maryland. Because there were a lot of loyalists.
This is a book of divided families. Many of the Marylanders in the Maryland in the Baltimore cadets, even their fathers, were loyal to the crown. And this is this is totally true in terms of as the war goes on too. And I actually bring into this story of Washington's Immortals the story of the first loyalist Maryland regiment, where it's basically a mirror image of what Gist is creating, where they create...
This was rooted on the Eastern Shore.
It's rooted on the Eastern Shore by kind of a Bill Gates kind of guy that was incredibly wealthy. He had his own island. He had his large plantations. His name was Chalmers, and he basically is fighting for the crown. He's sending out pamphlets and things and saying why we need to stay part of the crown, and he puts his fortune on the line and creates his own regiment as the war goes on. And that story, they never actually face each other in battle. The closest they come is the Loyalist regiment is actually guarding some of the baggage in the Battle of Monmouth, and that's about the closest that these two groups come to actually engaging in combat.
We need to take a quick break. Lots more to talk about when we come back with Patrick O'Donnell, military historian, author of Washington's Immortals. We'll talk about some of the other battles the Marylanders fought in. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking about Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the Revolution, with its author, military historian Patrick O'Donnell. So you said The Battle of Brooklyn was the biggest battle of the Revolution, but it was early on. The war went on and on. What else did the Maryland regiments do?
This is the 8-year story that's in Washington's Immortals. They're involved in the entire war, in almost all of the crucial battles of the war. After the Battle of Brooklyn, for instance, Washington sees the elite aspects, or the fact that they fight. They also are one of the few regiments at the time to have bayonets, which was very rare for many of the militia units and other elements of Washington's army at this time.
You're right. I think you used the word unique. You said the Marylanders were unique in that they were state-funded.
It's another aspect of in the sense that there's something known as the Continental Troops, which are funded by the Continental Government. The Marylanders were not only funded by the Continental Government, but they were also unique in the sense initially they were funded by the state of Maryland as a defense force, as well as a force that could fight in the field with Washington's army. So there's sort of a unique aspect of that initially.
But eventually
they become amalgamated into the Continental Army itself. And the if you trace the origins of the unit from the Baltimore Independent Cadets to what's known as Smallwood's Battalion, which actually fought in Brooklyn, to the multiple regiments, there are about 7, and other elements of it, you'd almost need an org chart on this that would fill this entire wall. It's rather complicated in terms of how it disperses itself and how its organization itself. And that's why, instead of writing a purely unit history, this book is the first Band of Brothers on the American Revolution. And what I mean by that is it focuses in on the main officers and enlisted men of the Maryland line. And it's not just Smallwood, for instance, who's the commanding officer at the time of Brooklyn. It's men like Thomas Kearney, who is a free African American that fights with the Marylanders. And the Marylanders, it starts out in a sense as an elite unit that's largely manned by some of the elites in Baltimore, but it becomes an image of what Maryland is like during the American Revolution. And it involves many, it's mixed in terms of its races as well as its classes. And no one knows exactly how many free African Americans were in the Maryland line, but there is one muster roll that survives from 1778 that suggests that there were about 7 to 8% at that time, that snapshot. So it could have been more or it could have been less. But what you find is some incredible heroes that are part of this unit that are African American. And one of the men that I focused on was a gentleman by the name of Thomas Kearney. And Thomas Kearney is a very interesting individual that begins shortly after the Battle of Brandywine Creek in 1777. He enlists in the Maryland line. And he fights, like most of these Marylanders, he fights through many, many battles during the American Revolution. But Kearney's main contribution in the Marylanders, besides the Battle of Long Island, their greatest contribution is actually in the South, in North Carolina and South Carolina, where arguably the war comes to an end. And it's there. That's the decisive theater. You have like Yorktown, but there are many, many battles that lead up to Yorktown that push Cornwallis towards Virginia. And Thomas Kearney is just one of these privates in the Maryland line that's part of these battles. For instance, at the Battle of Guilford Courthouse, Thomas Kearney bayonets 5 British soldiers. And we know this through his pension file and then also some newspaper accounts that survive his death. But I think the greatest story and why this book is a Band of Brothers is that Thomas Kearney was part of something known as the Forlorn Hope. And the Forlorn Hope is, you know, in the 18th century, this is a mission where men are not expected to come back. That's why it's called a Forlorn Hope. It's effectively a suicide mission. But they considered it a post of honor. And these men actually volunteered, like Kearney, to be part of the Forlorn Hope, and he was armed only with an axe to cut through an abattis or that surrounded a fortification, and they had to break through.
It's like a fence made of pointed
sticks and sharpened logs, and they had to break through that, breach that to get into the fort. And the fort that we're talking about is a place called 96. It's on the South Carolina and Georgia border. And there was a earthen fortification that was manned by loyalists, and it was under siege for over a month by General Greene and the Marylanders, as well as some militia units. And Kearney went into this assault as the Forlorn Hope and was cutting through the abattis when his commanding officer was shot in the head. And Kearney pulls him out and carries him off the field of battle. And I think the greatest thing, what I love about this book is the friendships that are formed in battle. And that friendship with his officer remains, and they become very close friends after the war. And there's evidence that he may have actually, when Lafayette returned to the United States after the war, his officer and Perry Benson was his name, who was a general officer in the War of 1812 and helped save St. Michael's. Interestingly enough, they were together when Lafayette returned, and I think that's what the Washington's Immortals is really about. It's about that those bonds of friendship that are formed in war.
Since you mentioned after the war, you write that Kearney was pretty much an invalid at the end of the war. I mean, he was so badly. I don't know whether he'd been wounded that much or just worn down by the physical trials that you make so clear that so many of the fighters went through. Did he eventually get a pension?
Yes. What I found so tragic is that so many of these men that fought for 7 years of war, they come home and they have nothing. And if you've got if you don't have a leg or an arm, it becomes really hard to survive, to make a living.
And especially if you're a black man in that time,
yes,
because you were going to be doing physical labor.
And this is where the Washington's Immortals is unique in the sense that I used what's known as pension files and records to tell in their own words what they went through. And these pension files, if you were lucky enough to survive the American Revolution in the 1820s or 30s, you would go down to the local courthouse and swear under oath what you saw and did. And sometimes it's just, I was with Perry Benson or I was with Mordecai Gist. And other times it's detailed, fleshed out accounts of battle, of what these men saw and did. And this is the hidden story of the American Revolution. And that's why so many of the pages of Washington's Immortals is filled in their own words through these pension records. And, that was the tragedy as I'm reading these things is you see these accounts and then you see what these men had at the end of the war. And, it's just, maybe in some cases it was a single animal or a cup or, in some cases the men that were tradesmen or shoemakers or whatever, they might have their trade goods. They have very few personal possessions, and many of these men were starving in some cases.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Patrick O'Donnell, military historian, author of 10 books. His latest is his first from the founding of the country is Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the Revolution. And that elite regiment hailed from Maryland. You write a lot from your expertise, your military expertise, about leadership and just some incredible stories that I hadn't come upon. Maybe they are well known, but of George Washington's leadership. What is your favorite?
Washington is just a sort of iconic, figure that we see on paintings and things like that. But Washington's Immortals, I thought, brought out the humanity of Washington through a pension file. And what I mean by that is one of the luckiest men of the Revolution maybe was a guy by the name of Lawrence Everhart. He was a Marylander. And Everhart was in Fort Washington in Manhattan. If you know where the George Washington Bridge, the base of the George Washington Bridge on the Manhattan side, that during the American Revolution in November 1776, picture this mile and a half long fort you know, like almost a Lord of the Rings type fort with multiple redoubts and lines of trenches, etc. But Lawrence Everhart was in there along with about 2,900 Americans. And Everhart, luckily, was somehow, as the fort was being attacked, was able to find a rowboat near the on the Hudson River and row across the river. Because what happened is that 2,900 of his fellow brothers in arms inside of Fort Washington, that it was assaulted by the British. The hero of the fort was Johann Rahl, who was actually the garrison, Hessian garrison commander at Trenton. But what happens next is many of the men inside of Fort Washington are massacred. They're bayoneted to death by the Hessians, and they're run through a massive gauntlet. The British and Hessian soldiers, after they capture our men, literally run them through a gauntlet, and they kick and punch them and steal their possessions. And Everhart rows across the Hudson River and comes upon a house. And inside the house is none other than George Washington himself watching the fall of Fort Washington through his spyglass. And Everhart captures that moment through his pension file. And what was so interesting in the research I had done was that he captures Washington with tears in his eyes as he sees his men being bayoneted or run through a gauntlet. So it's like, it's that sort of a different side of George Washington. And then the book captures, for instance, the Battle of Princeton, where, you know, this is 18th century warfare, where the commanding officer or general actually wasn't sitting in a rear area. He was leading his men. And, you know, one of the most famous lines is "Parade with me, fellows." And he literally changes the course of the battle as he leads the counterattack at Princeton. The Battle of Princeton, with the Marylanders included, was going horrendously bad at the beginning of the battle, and a British regiment was literally pushing parts of the Continental Army off the field, and Washington himself personally leads the counterattack and changes the course of the battle. And you see it again and again many times at places like the Second Battle of Trenton, or what's known as Assunpink Creek, where George Washington and the Marylanders, as well as many other units from Virginia, etc., they man a defensive line on the opposite side of something called Assunpink Creek, which is near in Trenton, but it's on the eastern side of Trenton. And he holds a stone bridge, which is one of the only crossing points. And it's a movie, really. I mean, it's a situation where the elite British troops under Cornwallis charge multiple times across that stone bridge, and General Washington, we have one of the accounts, his horse is literally on the side of the railing on the bridge. That's how close he is to the battle.
Let me hop back to Manhattan for a minute. Is it that same moment you're describing Washington with tears in his eyes, as seen by the Marylander described in his pension file? There's also a single page in this book where you use two adjectives that I've never heard applied to George Washington before. One is unhinged, and one is catatonic. He is so angry about, I think he's reacting to desertions on the battlefield.
What happens is about 2 weeks after the Battle of Brooklyn, and the Battle of Brooklyn, there's one of the greatest escapes in American history and world history occurs on a couple days after the battle, where a fog sets in and John Glover's Marblehead Mariners rescue the entire Continental Army. And they row across the East River, and then they make their way back to Manhattan. And about 2 weeks later after that event, the British land at Kipps Bay, which is not far from Murray Hill. And the landing occurs, and the entire army begins to run. And the Marylanders actually do fight, but many members of the Washington's army run and flee. And what happens, though, is Washington is on his horse, and he is catatonic. He actually freezes in the battle, and somebody actually has to come by and take the reins of his horse and lead him off the battlefield, because there was some that believe that he was willing to die there in battle.
Amazing stories that you have uncovered in Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the revolution. We need to take another quick break. Much more to talk about when we get back. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with military historian Patrick O'Donnell, who's gone deep into letters, pension records, other unpublished sources to write Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the Revolution. You have written 10 books about military activities, right? This is the first one that goes back to the Revolution. You've interviewed, I think, literally thousands of soldiers, fighters, veterans. Yes. You couldn't interview these people. How is this book different to write?
Well, there were those that said that this book couldn't even be written because the sources didn't exist. That was the concern. And it was like being an archaeologist, and you had a Roman mosaic, a beautiful Roman mosaic that had been shattered into tens of thousands of pieces, and just excavating, trying to find the various primary sources that tie this whole story together, and then tying the story together. So it was not just this is narrative history. It's there's a story arc here. It's a story of these men through the entire American Revolution. Some say it's a combat history of the entire American Revolution. And it's also a Band of Brothers type history that follows these key officers and enlisted men. And it also covers the men on the other side, the Hessians and the British, as well as my favorite part of the book in some ways are the deserters, people
really?
That literally change sides multiple times. And we have many cases in this book of people that switch sides many times. And that's because the American Revolution is not only a conventional war, it's a civil war, and it's also an insurgency. And I looked at it as from a very unique lens in some ways, and as an insurgency, as well as a civil war. In the civil war piece, you have people that literally change sides on the ebb and flow of victories and defeats. Or in some cases, it's as simple as if you get captured, you have an option. You can go on a prison ship that's basically a floating concentration camp, or you can fight for the British Army. And that's what some of these men do. They fight for the British Army, and then they are recaptured, and many of them are executed by the Continental Army, and then some are able to talk their way out of it. And we have one individual that literally changed sides 3 or 4 times. And his story is extraordinary. His name is Michael Doherty, and Michael Doherty is a member of the Delaware line. And I cover not only the Maryland line, but also the Delaware Blues in this story because they fight side by side through the entire war. And Michael Doherty is first captured at the Battle of Brandywine and takes, he's basically enlists in the British Army there, and he fights with the British Army. And he's then captured at a place called Stony Point, which is about 20 or so miles below West Point in New York, where there's an incredible battle where the Marylanders lead the Forlorn Hope. And actually, there's a great victory there in 1779. But they capture Michael Doherty again. And many of the Marylanders, or those that had changed sides, are executed. They make a series of gallows, and they execute people on the spot. But Michael Doherty is able to talk his way out of it somehow. Fights again with his brothers in the Delaware Blues. And in the Battle of Camden in August 1780, where it's another situation of a crushing defeat for the American Army. And Michael Doherty fights for the British again. And he is fighting for the British Army and is recaptured at a place called Cowpens.
In South Carolina,
which is an incredible American victory. And one of those leaders was John Eager Howard. His home is only literally several blocks away from this studio.
John Eager and Howard footprints are all over Baltimore. Eager Street, Howard Street.
The names of the streets are all here. That's why I love Baltimore. I mean, there's so much rich history here. And, you know, the footprints of the American Revolution are all over these street names and all over the place.
So John Eager Howard lets Daugherty go again?
He lets him go and he rejoins the Delaware Blues and fights through the rest of the war on our side.
You write that the Marylanders were in the forefront of devising an American style of combat, but you also write that the Brits were changing their style of combat.
You know, I think the thing that I found so interesting is many of the myths that we grew up with in our, you know, our high school textbooks and our grade school textbooks are completely wrong. I mean, everything from, you know, Johann Rahl and Trenton those men being drunk on Christmas and not being ready is completely false.
The Hessian troops
there
were not drunk.
They were incredibly well drilled and they were also well trained. But the other thing was that the British and Hessian army was very, very adaptable. And they were changing and adapting as the war went on. And it's a situation that's in some ways similar to the current environment where you have us in the United States has a very professional army, men, officers and enlisted men that are all volunteer force that have served many, many years. And they're a very professional army that's always adapting and changing. It's a learning organization, if you will. And the British Army of the time was very much the same way. And they were not adapting as fast as we were. And that is what we find. The American style and way of war, which really begins in the French and Indian War, and it continues through the American Revolution.
How would you describe it?
In a sense, it's a cultural artifact. You can look at it as it's something that morphs in the American Revolution, and it's everything from like Cowpens, for instance, that we take that battle, which is in South Carolina with John Eager Howard and Daniel Morgan, where they develop. They have a real problem. They've got an excellent British army to fight against, and they have these poorly trained militia guys that don't want to fight. So they devise something called a defense in depth, where they put their worst soldiers, the militia. I wouldn't say worst, but they're fickle. They're not able to withstand a bayonet charge in most cases, and they don't. You know, they're not as seasoned as the Marylanders. And he asks them to fire three shots and then retreat. And it's a defense. There's a series of defensive lines, and the British have to break through this defense in depth is one example. And another place, for instance, like at Pelham Bay, which is in the Bronx, the Americans fight behind trees and logs and behind stone walls, and they use that as cover, and then they continue to fall back. And then there's also the American way of, you know, use of firepower, overwhelming firepower on the field of battle, use of intelligence in putting all these things together. An excellent example would be Stony Point, where this was an incredible raid or slash assault where we used intelligence to glean the exact order of battle in the defenses at Stony Point, and we attacked the weak points there. And you know, these are a lot of the things that come from the American Revolution. And I also say that the one thing that I was really impressed with was that the ideals of the American Revolution generally it transferred from not only a political sense but also onto the battlefield and how we treated prisoners of war and other things. It was called. John Adams called it the spirit of humanity. And this is something that we see that transcends not only politics, but it also is imbued on many of the battlefields that we see where the Marylanders fight. And I think that those ideals are as relevant. They were as relevant in 1776 as they are today.
I was very struck by what you wrote about the way from the get-go, from the first time Washington had a chance to take prisoners, his determination not to treat them the way you were describing earlier, the way the Brits and the Hessians had treated the Americans. You quote a British officer in the Battle of Brooklyn being shocked at the viciousness of the Hessians killing American fighters after the course of the battle was clear. It was clear that the Americans are losing the battle, and one might have expected that therefore you would stop killing people, and the Hessians didn't. So, and I really wanted to believe it, but I also wonder when I think of how, I mean, you make so vivid the privations, especially of the winter of 76, 77, of the barefoot soldiers, of the soldiers without enough to eat. How could they make good on those ideals of treating prisoners humanely when they had so little for the American troops?
It was done. And there are clearly examples in the South, in the Southern theater, where those rules were not upheld. And for instance, the partisan warfare that took place in the South. But in general, those members of the Continental Army conducted themselves through the spirit of humanity. And it's an amazing thing. I mean, you have after the war or during the war, you have many British soldiers actually fighting for us. Or the Hessians. And I think the one thing that struck me the most was there was a line by General Greene, who takes over the Southern Army in 1781, so where they're fighting at the Battle of Eutaw Springs, and this is before Yorktown. It's deep in the South, near Charleston. And he says something that's just absolutely startling. He talks about the description of his army, which the men are literally in rags. They don't have shoes. They have their cartridge belts. They have to use moss to put underneath the belt to prevent the leather from rubbing the skin. But the most startling thing that he says is, many of the men that were in my army are now fighting for the British, and the British are now fighting for me. In other words, many men that had they deserted from the British Army were now fighting for Greene and his army.
But the reverse also.
And the reverse also. And that's the sort of the fluid nature of this the Civil War. But what you see is it's all about leadership in many ways. It's about this core group of men, best friends, that hold it together. It's a story of resilience. A story of resilience of 7 years of war that aren't paid in most cases, are underfed. In some cases, they're under-equipped, and they're fighting all of these externalities. And I think that the elements, that's another aspect of this, where people are literally living outside with no tents for months at a time. And how they do that, I don't know.
That's military historian Patrick O'Donnell here on Midday on WIPR. We're talking about his new book, Washington's Immortals, The Untold Story of an Elite Regiment Who Changed the Course of the Revolution. You write in detail about, we talked about George Washington's leadership, but you write a lot about the leadership of the Maryland leaders like Mordecai Gist and Sam Smith. And the cohesion of the Maryland troops in the Battle of Brooklyn. But the Maryland forces suffered so many losses, and we're constantly hearing about its leaders going back to Maryland, recruiting more on their own dime, getting more volunteers. So there were constantly new recruits. That cohesion just fell apart. How did they continue to lead, or were they able to recreate that cohesion?
These are men that just believed. They believed against all odds in most cases that they would prevail. And it was just, and in some cases it's a small group of men, but that small group of men were so ardent that they held the whole thing together. And that's something you see over and over. And then they have to, the Washington's army is literally rebuilt, especially the army in the South, several times over the backs of these Marylanders. Because they are the only thing that holds the whole thing together, basically. And these new recruits come in, and it's not necessarily a pretty situation. I mean, they literally have to create a draft in Maryland. They're bringing out, there's literally, the sheriff goes around in some cases, and they pull out people that are homeless, that don't have a home. They're basically shipped off into the army in some cases. And then, of course, you still have volunteers, but it's, The war is dynamic and it's changing and Maryland plays a huge role in the war itself, not only on the battlefield but elsewhere.
Mordecai Gist, I had not heard of before your book. Sam Smith, I had, because he, after the Revolutionary War, he served in the Maryland legislature. He headed the defense of Fort McHenry when the British bombed it during the War of 1812. And then he ended up also being mayor of Baltimore.
He's the savior of Baltimore in the War of 1812. And Sam Smith is one of the great friends and band of brothers in this book. He's friends with Gist. He's friends with a guy by the name of Jack Stewart, who, interestingly enough, the two men dueled. So they were mortal enemies right before the war. But both men obviously survived and then became the closest of friends. And Sam Smith is just he's with the original Baltimore Independent Cadets in 1774 and fights through most of the war. And Smith's famous defense is at a place called Mud Island or Fort Mifflin. And this is on the river, the Schuylkill River, not far from the present-day Philadelphia airport, is Fort Mifflin. And Smith and his regiment of Marylanders, along with some Virginians and others, had to hold this thing against pretty much one of the longest sieges of the American Revolution. And it was being constantly shelled and bombarded. It's quite interesting. There are two ships that literally assault the fort, the Augusta and the Merlin, and they're blown to they're destroyed in the assault itself. And Smith holds out until the very bitter end. And tragically, a cannonball comes down a chimney where he's in his officer's quarters and then comes through the chimney and basically almost just kills him. It nicks his hip and it severely wounds him and puts him out of the war.
We're almost out of time, and I need to take this back to where we started. The 256 Marylanders killed in the Battle of Brooklyn, we still don't know where they're buried.
It's the entire reason why I wrote this book, Sheila, is because I wanted, it's a national tragedy that men that saved the United States are buried under a street or in an empty lot somewhere in Brooklyn, and we don't know where. And there's a lot of evidence that points to certain locations. And, you know, it's been my goal to build awareness on this tragedy and to properly identify and find this mass grave. I mean, it's in the heart of Brooklyn. And this is arguably as important as Gettysburg, if not more, because the United States there was a possibility that we would not be here had it not been for the efforts of these men, these American Spartans. And I think that's been the goal of Washington's Immortals, is to bring awareness to people and into the issue of the mass grave.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this hour's conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Military historian Patrick O'Donnell. He's the author of 10 books. His most recent is Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the Revolution. This Saturday will be the 240th anniversary of the Maryland Regiment's heroic assault on the Old Stone House in Brooklyn, New York, that the British Army was using as headquarters during the first and biggest battle of the Revolution. The attack cost 256 Maryland men their lives, but bought a precious hour that let most of George Washington's army escape to fight another day. The Battle of Brooklyn was the first of many during the Eight-Year War in which the Maryland men turned the tide of battle. Glad you've been with us this hour. Tune in tomorrow. Political campaigns are all about rhetoric. How exceptional is the rhetoric this election cycle? What can political campaigns of the past tell us about the one we're living through? Rhetoric and politics, that's tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.